Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks so much for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have a very important conversation lined up for you. One of the biggest news stories over the past 2 weeks has been the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and its impact on our banking and financial systems. To help us better understand how all of this works and what happened, I'm joined now by Sultan Meghji, former Chief Innovation Officer at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, also known as the FDIC. He's also a Duke professor and venture capitalist. Sultan, thanks so much for coming on the show to help break this down. And I really want to take a step-by-step approach to this issue because it can be a bit confusing. So let's start with our banking system. What role do banks play in our economy, and what are some of their core functions?
Well, thanks for having me back, Ryan. It's great to talk to you again. So the way to think about it is all of the money in the United States is created and managed and run by the federal government through the central bank of the United States. That's the Federal Reserve. Back about 100 years ago, a little more, when the Great Depression happened, the Federal Reserve realized that they needed to be able to directly put money into local communities. And so they created a number of banks called Federal Reserve Banks. And you might hear people talk about the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, for example. That is a private bank that is owned and run by the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C., and that's where the money actually comes from. So your bank on Main Street, whether it's a big money center bank in New York or a small bank, you know, a one branch bank in a small town, and let's say, you know, we'll keep with the theme of rural Missouri, they get the actual dollars that you care about, you and I care about, from these local Federal Reserve Banks and the Federal Home Loan Banks, which are two structures there. That system has existed for, you know, over 100 years. Before that, every bank had their own money. You could get a J.P. Morgan dollar or a Morgan Stanley dollar. But back in the late 19th century, they created the system where the Federal Reserve note. So if you actually look at the paper money you carry, if you carry it, it'll say it's a note of the Federal Reserve. It comes from the central bank to these regional Federal Reserve banks that then goes to the local banks that you and I would interact with. So that's where the money comes from the treasurer and from the mint, and it flows into that system. Now, there are two ways that that money is used. The first is just the dollars that you and I would put in our pockets. And the second is they create loans. And so pretty much every bank in the country borrows money from the Federal Reserve at an interest rate. So every time we talk about the chairman and the people at the Federal Reserve raising the interest rates, that's what they're talking about. It's the rate that the Federal Reserve lends money to the banks, you know, that you and that you and I interact with.
Right.
And so the higher that rate goes, the banks then have to charge more than that rate in order to make money. So, you know, they borrow the money at, let's say, 4% in the current rate environment, 4.5%. And then you want to get a mortgage, let's say. Well, they have to charge you more than that 4.5% because they have to still make money, because that percent differential, that arbitrage, is how the bank actually makes money. So that's the basics of how that system works.
And there are different sized banks across the country, correct? You've got the really big ones, and then you've got these regional banks, which we're hearing more and more about now, including Silicon Valley Bank.
That's right. You know, there are a little over 4,500 banks in the United States right now. It used to be, you know, about 30,000 back in the 80s. And, you know, every year we lose some. You know, it's about 1.5% every year we lose. And in 2008, we lost, you know, hundreds, obviously. And there are really two types of banks. There's state banks, where they get their banking charter from the state. And then there's the second category of federal, and they get their charters either from the Federal Reserve or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Generally, federal banks are bigger banks and state banks are smaller banks. You will see, though, that there are some state banks that are quite large. You know, an example would be UBS, which in the United States, you know, it's a $100 billion plus bank, but it's a bank out of South Dakota, if memory serves. It's a state bank. And Silicon Valley Bank is a great example of that. They're a California state bank, so not a national bank, but a state bank. Managed by the California banking regulators, that went from zero to very large very quickly, and as such was categorized as a regional bank, but it was the 16th, I think, largest bank in the country when it collapsed.
The banks that went down during the 2007-2008 financial crisis, were those the bigger banks? Were they regional banks like what we're seeing with Silicon Valley Bank, a combination?
So 2008 is kind of an interesting situation because it really was across a wide category of banks. There were some banks that were quite small that were really exposed and some that were quite large. You know, Bank of America even took a big hit in 2008, you know, and that's basically, you know, one of the largest. The issue in 2008, which we see, which is not really like what we see today, but the issue in 2008 was that a lot of these banks would take the deposits of their customers and the loans from the federal government, like I talked about a moment ago, and then invest it. And in one of the biggest concentrations in 2008 that caused issues was they were buying equities, they were buying mortgage-backed securities, especially those for subprime borrowers, which basically means people with lower credit scores, you know, who are riskier, you know, people than you know, kind of the lower 50% of people, who are getting mortgages. And what happened was, with all of the different economic pressures on the system, home values dropped. And all of a sudden, the mortgages were worth more than the homes were. And the banks had to cover that differential. And that took money out of their own bank accounts. And that caused a large number of banks. I think it ended up being over 400 to end up having to close because of that exposure. That's very different than what we're seeing today with Silicon Valley Bank, for example.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Sultan Meghji, former Chief Innovation Officer at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, also known as the FDIC. He's also a Duke professor. I know we're not very far removed from the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and subsequent fallout, so there's a lot that I'm sure still needs to be studied and looked into. But based on what we do know right now, what are some of the things that led to this collapse?
It's a great question, Ryan, and I'm glad that you're asking it. I hope this becomes more of a discussion as we get farther away from this. You know, the three biggest issues that Silicon Valley Bank had, number one was they did not have the people and the processes internally to really manage the risk that they had taken on. You know, they didn't have a chief risk officer for a while, and that's kind of a normal thing for a bank to have. They weren't doing a good job about paying attention to their exposure. If they had too many assets in one bucket, they weren't managing their investments very well. I mean, there's a lot to talk about there. So that was really the first problem. They weren't managing themselves very effectively. And when things were good, interest rates were low, you know, a lot of money was flowing around, that was less of a concern because they had more money in the bank. But over the last year, and this gets to the second thing that went on, is that they were very exposed to increasing interest rates from the Federal Reserve. And in the last year, we've seen the single largest increase in rates from the Federal Reserve ever, you know, basically zero to, you know, four and change here in about a year. That's never been done before. And we don't really know what the first, second, and third order impacts of that are. And I think we've just started to see the first, which then leads to the third issue. If all of a sudden you've borrowed a bunch of money at a very low rate, let's say 1%, and then you're using that money to invest in things, and that investment is returning, let's say, 3 or 4%. That's great. But there's what we call an inverse correlation, where when interest rates go up, some things that were making money actually go down. So you borrow at 1 and you make 3. Okay, great. You've made 2% on whatever that dollar amount is. But when the interest rates go up to 4, some of those investments, especially bonds and mortgage-backed securities again, that number goes from 2 and that maybe goes down a little bit. And all of a sudden, instead of making money, you're losing money. And that's what happened with Silicon Valley Bank, is they all of a sudden went from making a bunch of money on their investments to losing a bunch of money. And they had to basically take a write down. They had extra cash in the bank and they basically had to say, okay, we have to write off those investments and move forward. And that happened in a couple of different categories. And all of them hit at basically the same 8-week window. And so then they go off and they try to raise some more money. They tried to do a bond. They tried to get more deposits. And it all kind of fell apart at the last minute. I mean, everything happened within about a 72-hour window for them. And it was a perfect storm of mismanagement, higher cost of capital, and then lower return on investment that led to them all of a sudden being illiquid.
What about this $250,000 threshold that we've heard so much about in relation to the FDIC?
Well, again, this is a great question, Ryan. I'm glad you're asking this. I've gotten this a few times. So the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, I think people should think about that name. You know, you think about it, it's like it's a federal agency. Well, it's kind of half a federal agency and half a private company. It is a corporation, and it was created to do two things. One was to create an insurance fund, and that's called the Deposit Insurance Fund. And when you see that at a bank and it says your deposits are insured up to $250,000, that is what that fund is there for. And at varying points, it has hundreds of billions of dollars inside it to specifically protect the average American checking and savings account. And since its inception, no insured depositor has lost a penny. And that is an incredible success. And it speaks very highly to how it was created back in the 1930s. The second thing that the FDIC has done and was created to do was to, in conjunction with the states, the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, Federal Reserve, and other parts of the federal government, was built and has been the primary regulator for banks in the United States. So what does that mean? It means if you're a bank, you and I just couldn't walk down the street and decide to start a bank. It's a little more complicated than that. You need millions of dollars. You need to, you know, they do background investigations on people. You have to get technology, and you have to go through a regulatory process at both the state and the federal level to make sure that you know what you're doing. We have the best banking system in the world, and one of the reasons is because we create pretty high walls to entry. So it used to be really easy to start a bank, you know, a couple million bucks, fill out some forms, you're done. Now it's, you know, $30, $40, $50 million, 5 to 7 years, you know, 20 to 30 people, and then it goes up from there. And so the FDIC has, you know, roughly speaking, 4,000 people running around the country, checking out the banks to make sure they're being run effectively. And so over the last couple of weeks, I've had to remind people a few times that as long as you stayed under $250,000 in your bank account, you're fine, which is, you know, 99.999% of Americans, right? If you're in some of the larger banks, the two big fail banks, we call them, you know, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, et cetera, that number was always kind of informally much higher than $250,000. But $250,000 is what the government kept as a standard until Sunday, when Secretary Yellen, the heads of the various agencies, Biden administration, all got together and said, we're going to take the entire deposit insurance fund at the FDIC, as well as another facility at the Federal Reserve, and carve off about $300 billion and protect every depositor in every deposit account, no matter how much money was in it. And that's never really been done before either. But what it did do, as it rightly should have, is make sure that every American understood that your checking account's fine. It might take you a day or two to get it if you're in one of these banks that got shut down, but, you know, no more than 24 hours. And you're fine. Your deposits are fine. You know, and that got announced on Sunday, and people could start pulling money out by 9:30, you know, Monday morning.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Sultan Meghji, former Chief Innovation Officer at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, also known again as the FDIC. He's also a Duke professor and venture capitalist. And we're talking about these issues that have been in the news involving our banking and financial system. What does it mean when people hear there are concerns that we could see a run on banks?
Well, a run on a bank is when a bunch of customers unexpectedly show up at the front door and say, give me my money. That's what a bank run is. And it used to be because people would run down the street to get their money from the banks. Back in the 19th century and really through the Great Depression, that happened more than a few times. It happened all over the world. In fact, it still happens in some parts of the world more often than most people would hear about. Most of the time, a bank keeps anywhere from 8 to 20% of their depository capital directly on hand. That means you walk in and you can do it. So if a bank is worth, let's say it's worth $1 billion, $100 million, let's use something, keep it something about $100 million, they would have between $8 and $20 million directly available to give you if you walked in at a moment's notice. Once you get over that 20% or close to that 20% line, then all of a sudden they're actually out of cash and they have to go to, you know, one of the federal home loan banks or you know, one of the other U.S. government facilities to get that cash to do that. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, it was right at about 20% of their depository capital, about $40-some billion walked out the door in less than 72 hours, which when Washington Mutual failed in the Great Financial Crisis, that was, I think it was $17 billion in 6 days or something like that. So the Silicon Valley Bank might be the actual greatest run on a bank in American history. Same thing happened with Signature Bank over the weekend. They lost right at about 20%, and that's when the federal government came in to shut them down. Beyond that 20%, you know, it's important to remember that the only way banks make money is to take your deposits and go off to invest it in things or lend it to people or whatever they do. And so most of the time, they don't have that much cash on hand. And so if all of a sudden there are a lot of people asking for cash, it can cause a lot of pressure and stress. And if in the age of social media, it's very easy to create a panic around, you know, the safety and soundness of a bank. And that's what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank. And I think it's also what we saw with Signature Bank.
When you say banks can take our money and invest it, another way that they make money, correct?
Correct.
What are some of the rules in place in terms of risk to make sure that they're not investing in the wrong things that could end up getting them in trouble?
Well, this is a really interesting question, Ryan. I'm glad you asked it. So the rules are really interesting. You would think if you and I sat down and said, okay, let's create a risk system so that the banks don't do something stupid that makes us lose our money and all that stuff, you would think that there were some pretty prescriptive rules, right? Some very clear guidelines, you know, kind of a form that says, you know, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. But that's not how the regulatory system in the United States works for banks. What instead of the FDIC, for example, instead of saying, are you investing more than 10% of your depositary capital into mortgage-backed securities? We think 10% is the most you should do. They don't say that. What they should say is, tell us what process you have to make sure that you're not investing too much money in mortgage-backed securities. Do you hear the difference between those two things?
Yeah. Right?
One is really direct. It says, do not pass go, do not do this. And the other is, tell us that you've created a process, a risk management process that ensures that you're doing that. And that second version is how most of the banks in the United States operate and how they're examined. And that leaves us quite vulnerable in some cases to new risks, to compression of risk, to concentration of risk, because it assumes that we take them at their face value. And once every couple of years, the team from the FDIC or one of the other regulatory bodies goes in and kind of looks and makes sure they have a big binder with a form, with all the forms and the workflows and all that kind of stuff. But it does make it a very human process. And any human process is highly fallible. And that's, you know, that's another weakness of the system.
The term contagion that's used in association with these kinds of events, it's obviously not pandemic related, which is good. I think we've had enough of that, but this isn't good in this case either. What does it refer to in regards to our financial system?
It's psychological, right? So, you know, a contagion, you know, you and I could walk down the street and get exposed to a very small amount of a contagion and our immune system fights it off, right? Metaphorically, and that happens in the banking system on a daily basis. You know, banks are offline on a daily basis because of ransomware attacks, because of their own, you know, mismanagement, because their balance sheets are off. Like, this happens on a daily basis. And the immune system for that in the United States is the banking regulatory system. I feel like contagion is not the best metaphor for this discussion, because it's really not just a contagion. It's a contagion of psychology that kind of runs out of control. So it's a fever in the minds of so many people where they think, oh goodness, I'm hearing bad stuff about my bank. I'd better pull my money out. And because of, you know, how fast things like, you know, Twitter spread, you know, mostly bad information, it gets us to a point where there's a fever in the people and they'll yank their money out. And that's again what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank.
What are some of the issues the Federal Reserve is responsible for dealing with? You really stepped through a lot of what the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation does, but what about the Federal Reserve?
Well, the Federal Reserve is really, you know, three different entities, or I guess four technically, that are wrapped into one umbrella. One is it is the primary monetary policy engine of the United States. So how we think about our money as a nation really is owned by the Federal Reserve. And their biggest the biggest feature of that is their interest rates that they charge, both, you know, other banks in the United States as well as globally, because we are the biggest check writer globally. The second thing is it's also a regulatory engine. And so most of the very largest banks are directly managed by the Federal Reserve, you know, these big money center banks, and they do all the things a regulator would do as well. I already talked about the Federal Reserve banks, which, you know, in theory are separate, but in reality, we've seen that they aren't as highly coordinated. And, you know, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, let's say of Kansas City, you know, won't make any decisions without the Federal Reserve Board, you know, in D.C., you know, signing off on it. Whether or not that's what the law says, that's what clearly happens. And then finally, it is an externally facing central bank globally, right? And it is, you know, the most important one and has a deep relationship with the World Bank and the IMF and the European Central Bank and, you know, kind of all the other big central banks around the world. And so the Federal Reserve is a very complicated entity. In fact, in many ways, it's probably one of the most complicated entities in the U.S. government. And it's unique in terms of how it's organized. No other country has a system like the way we do because of the independence of our states, because of the different regulatory systems. And in many ways, the Federal Reserve is kind of the center hub with all these other spokes sticking out of it, whether it's the FDIC, the OCC, parts of Treasury, the state regulatory bodies, other nations. It also serves a fundamental coordinating point.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Sultan Megji, former Chief Innovation Officer at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, again, also known as the FDIC. He's also a Duke professor and venture capitalist. You mentioned earlier that one part of the equation that led to the downfall of Silicon Valley Bank had to do with the increase in interest rates that we've seen recently from the Federal Reserve. Can you explain how that works and why that's something that is happening with the Federal Reserve right now?
Sure. The easiest way to think about it is the single biggest impact to the functioning of the American economy, from the highest level to the money you and I put in our pockets or how much our credit card interest is based on this interest rate that the Federal Reserve has as it lends money out through the reserve banks to the banking system. That's where all the money comes from, is kind of as we began this discussion. And it is the single most impactful thing that they can control. Now, it's also one of the few things they can directly control. You know, they can't do anything about the spending of the government. That's a congressional issue and an executive branch issue. But they can change how expensive it is to borrow money, which is how this works. We create money as a nation. We pay our taxes. We do all the other things. That creates this big reserve inside of the Fed. And then they lend that back out to everyone else. And that's how the global economy works. When the Federal Reserve needs to slow the economy down, which is what they've been trying to do now for a year, to ease inflation, the easiest and really only thing they can do is just make it more expensive to borrow money so that companies slow down, which then slows down what they can increase the rate of price increase, which then slows down what people can buy. And it just, the idea is makes everything more expensive to slow everything down, to cool everything off. The challenge is that right now, really for the first time ever, we have a situation where that process is not actually slowing the economy down as much as we'd like. We still have 2 open jobs for every 1 person looking. We still have inflation. You know, I think it's normal. The annualized number from last week came out at 6%. So it's down a little bit. You know, we're still seeing a very robust, very aggressive, very fast-growing economy. You know, corporate profits are at record levels, especially in areas like energy and food and healthcare. But we aren't able to slow down even at this high interest rate. And the most direct impact of that increase in high interest rates is it goes right to the banks, which makes it more expensive for them to operate. And the only way they can do that is raise their costs. And that hits the average American with car loans, home loans, and credit cards faster and more directly than anything else. So whether intentionally or not, all the ways that we're all hurting a little bit more financially in our home is a direct result of this interest rate hike. And the second order impact of actually slowing the economy down is happening, but it's happening much slower. If you go back to the late 1970s, we had a Fed chair named Volcker, and a very similar situation occurred. And instead of doing a quarter of a point hike, a half point hike, he went from very low to very high in basically, I think it was 3 rate hikes. And it was kind of rip the Band-Aid off. Take it from, you know, take it all the way up, slow everything down, shock the system, get everybody to relax, and then very quickly start lowering it again. The Federal Reserve here waited probably 2 or 3 quarters too long to raise rates, and they started very slowly and only really got aggressive about it in the back half of last year because they were trying to engineer this soft landing, which I'm sure you've heard people talk about. The idea was to slow down the economy, cool it off so that it would kind of come back down naturally and slowly instead of having this big shock to the system.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening right now and they're wondering, so how does all of this impact the markets that we hear so much about, the stock market volatility that we've seen? What role does everything that we've talked about when it comes to our banking system, the role of the FDIC, the role of the Federal Reserve, how does that impact that part of the economy?
Well, just like for all of us as normal people, you know, when you're trying to borrow money from the bank, if it's more expensive to borrow money from the bank, you're not going to borrow it, or maybe not going to borrow as much, whether it's a home mortgage or a car loan or a credit card or whatever. Same is true for corporate America. You know, pretty much every public company out there has some degree of debt, and some underwriting piece of that debt is the Federal Reserve, one way or another. That's just the nature of how our economy works. And so if a company can figure out how to pass that increase in cost on downstream to other companies and to, you know, consumers, they will, and they'll continue to make money. And we certainly see that. That means the market is higher. And so any company that's doing very well right now is basically passing on the increased cost of the borrowing from the Fed downstream to either other companies or to us.
And last question for you, another term that we've heard some, and this has directly to do with Silicon Valley Bank, venture capitalism. And you're a perfect person to ask about this. What exactly is that and how does that industry work?
Well, venture capital is the primary engine by which innovation is commercialized and scaled in the United States. Whether we're talking about the, you know, Google and going all the way back to the creation of the internet, or you know, the creation of the personal computer or the COVID vaccine, all of these are where investors, either, you know, people like me or banks or big asset managers, somebody with money, goes to a firm, and for a long time, it's, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, outside San Francisco was considered the home of this because it's where Xerox and Apple and Microsoft and you know, HP and companies like that came from. They create these companies that invest in startups. And so, you know, let's say you and I wanted to start a radio company, right? We would write up a presentation. We'd get some people who know this. We'd figure out what the business model is. We'd make a presentation. And if they liked it, they would give us some money for a percent of the company. And that's what venture capital does. And they'll invest in 10 companies. 2 of them, they assume will fail. 6 of them, they'll assume they'll break even. And 2 of them, they'll make a lot of money on. And that's been a great industry for a long time. And it's been the engine by which pretty much every interesting brand you can think of has come out of that one way or another. Silicon Valley Bank for the last, you know, 15 years has been the de facto leader in that space. In fact, they really created and owned a piece of venture capital called Venture Debt. They own 40% of it as of 2 weeks ago. You know, definitely a dominant player. And whether you're a startup, whether you're a venture capital firm, a private equity firm, you did business with Silicon Valley Bank. And so your bank accounts were there. Maybe they helped on the investment banking side. They were your one-stop shop for a long time. Venture capital also is where all of the IPOs come from. So if you ever hear about a company going public, very likely that's, you know, 3, 5, 6, 7, I think the average is about 7 years after the first venture capital investment in that company.
Sultan Meghji, former Chief Innovation Officer at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. He's also a Duke professor and venture capitalist with us to break down all the news that we've been seeing so much about when it comes to our banking system and financial system over the past couple of weeks. Sultan, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to come on and offer all of that insight and expertise. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Ryan. Always great to talk to you.
All right, and that's going to do it for this edition of iHeartRadio Communities. As we wrap things up, I want to offer a big thanks to our guest, of course, and to all of you for listening. If you want to hear previous episodes of the show, we're on your iHeartRadio app. Just search for iHeartRadio Communities. I'm your host, Ryan Gorman. We'll talk to you again real soon.